In Wenham, I got involved in the Democratic Party through Evelyn Malone, and her brother-in-law was Roland Muller, who had a position in the State Democratic Party, and they were staunch supporters of Hubert Humphrey, and told me all about him, and they were enthusiastic about him. And, I didn't know a lot about politics. I knew nothing about politics, but I knew that the Democratic Party was was the party that I was more attracted to, certainly, than the Republican Party. And I do think that I was thinking that that it would be good to be involved in the Democratic Party, that I was always interested in doing something about wars and stopping wars, and so this would be a good way to go. And so I got involved, and Evelyn was a dear friend, and I loved her. She was an entirely selfish woman, and I shouldn't say that entirely, but she was quite selfish and beautiful. And we would attend once in a while a meeting in the Twin Cities State Central Committee meeting, because Roland, her brother-in-law, was a member of the State Central Committee. And I don't know how it happened, it's been so long ago, but eventually I was elected chairwoman of the Democratic Party. Now, there was a chairman and a chairwoman in the Democratic Party.
Chairwoman of the Wyndham area?
Or yeah, of the county. Of the county. Yeah, Cottonwood County. And I was elected the chairwoman of the Cottonwood County Democrat. Now, that's not a great election. There are not many people that want this job.
Right.
So I was. And the chairman at that time was Albert Piper, who was a farmer. And the meetings that we had, it was interesting, because we'd have these county meetings, and they'd be out in the countryside, out in the farmland, and they'd be at these little town halls, and cold and very spare, and we'd go, and there'd be five or six people there. You'd have a township meeting, and so as the county chairwoman, you were supposed to. There was, of course, nothing that told you what exactly you were supposed to do, but we were supposed to be solvent and have money, and the counties were supposed to help support the state party, and so we did that. And we did that, and I was quite active in doing that, by having an annual dinner at which all the people that we knew would be invited, and we would then invite a politician from the Twin Cities to come down and talk. That would be the drawing card. And it was through these that I learned to know some of the people. Orville Freeman was down there one time, and Don Fraser, and Walter Mondale, and Eugene McCarthy. And so I knew them, and they're not, I was competent, and I knew what to do, and so I think I gained a reputation as being efficient and so forth. And I will tell you a little bit about each of those people. Orville Freeman came down, and Orville Freeman had been in the war. He was your father's classmate, and Walter knew him. They weren't great friends or anything, but they knew each other, and he had a part of his face blown off, I guess you might say, during the war. And he was at a meeting. We had a speech or something at a school building, and I was to introduce him. And so I introduced him and talked about why I worked in politics, which was for peace, and how important it was in the world that we would be a peaceful nation. And it just really ticked him off. He came right and said that we would have a peaceful world when people had to fight for peace. And he was there to tell him that that's the way peace came. So he just negated everything that I had said. And that was okay. I mean, it wasn't okay, but that was it. I knew his wife, Jane, and I liked her. And McCarthy, Don Fraser came down, and he was a congressman from the Twin City area. And very low-key, very nice man, a very honest man. I had him down there 2 or 3 times, and I was a great supporter. He never recognized me when I would be in the city, and I'd say, he'd look at me, kind of blink his eyes, and then I'd have to remind him. And I loved it, because that told me he was really an honest person, because the rest of the politicians would say, geez, great to see you. You're looking great. How's everything down there? Without telling where it was, because they didn't know where it was. But Don Fraser refused to play this game. He never told me. He just refused to play it. McCarthy, I was always impressed with McCarthy because he was so bright and so witty. And he was, I think he was in the Congress up here. So these people would come down, we'd pay him a little money, and they'd give a speech, go back home. His wife was an absolute pill. Abigail was her name. And when he ran for president, McCarthy, I campaigned for him in Gary, Indiana, and he had set up an office there. And who went there with me? Oh, you wouldn't remember him, but Christensen, what was his first name? Henry Christensen was the priest in Wyndham.
Okay.
And I think this was the first church he ever had. And I found out he was a distant relative of Eugene McCarthy's. Mm-hmm. So when I went to Gary, Indiana, I stayed at a hotel there. Somehow or another, Henry Christensen came too and was involved in it for a little bit. And when I got to Gary, Indiana, there was a bunch of really ruthless, bad people there, as far as I was concerned. And when I characterized them as bad, I would tell you that they were so, and this, you'll always find this around politicians, these ambition, especially young men, they are so gung-ho, they want to get to the top, and they're there with the senator, the congressman, whoever it is. And they stayed in the hotel too. And I watched them operate. There was a storefront that McCarthy had, that the campaign had, and they were, the people would, it was in, Gary is a very poor town, and the people would come in the front door of this little campaign office, and they would be too busy talking policy in the back. Nobody paid any attention to the people, and that's really essential, that you recognize the people who come. And I watched them, and I was horrified. And I did try to talk to them a little bit. And then in the hotel where we were staying, they were sleeping around with each other, the men and the women, the young men and the young women. And I didn't know that, but I did not like the way they treated the staff at the hotel, the elevator people. I just watched it. And they were very contemptuous of me, and I was older and so forth. And I finally decided I couldn't work with them anymore. And so I got up early one morning, and I decided to go back to Minnesota. And then I ran into one of the women who worked in the hotel, and she told me what I'm telling you. I said to her, I just really can't hack this. Well, she said, they're impossible young people, impossible. Mm-hmm. So I got in touch with McCarthy, and he fired a couple of them. And then one of them was a man named Tony Podesta, and your sister Barbara met him someplace, and she was really taken with him. I could not believe it, but she was. His brother is a man named Podesta, whose name I have seen in Washington since then, who's been involved, and they started an organization called Americans for the Democratic Way, and I think about him when I see it. But they didn't have any good feeling about me because they knew that I was really, upset with them. I was also doing work for Abigail McCarthy, who was Eugene's wife, and they were setting up meetings for her, And she had taught, I think, at St. Catherine's. And she had said that she didn't want political meetings. She wanted, I think I told you this, ecumenical meetings. They were to be ecumenical, religious meetings. And so I met these women in Gary, Indiana, whose husbands were working men. I mean, they worked with their hands. They were not professional people. And Gary is a working class town. And I said to them what she wanted, and they laughed. And they said to me, her husband is running for president. I said, yes. They said, these are political meetings. And so I agreed with them right down the line. So anyhow, I did leave Gary, Indiana. And what else did I do there? I also did the same kind of stuff for Humphrey when he ran. I was at a meeting in the state of Washington, and there was a man out there. I just found things that just didn't sit right with me, named Pat O'Connor, who's a big lawyer. And I don't know what was going on out there, but I did not agree with the conclusions he had drawn about the political situation, and I said so. But I did meet some interesting people. I'm wondering if Evelyn Malone didn't go with me. I don't remember. But I do remember some events at some gorgeous houses out there. These were rich people who were supporting Humphrey. And it was interesting and it was fun. So this would have been when I was living in Wyndham.
And you characterized everyone except Humphrey. Any impressions of Humphrey off the bat, or?
Well, I don't think I ever really knew him. I wrote him a letter one time. I got so disgusted with
him. Right, you told me about that, yeah.
And he was a brilliant person. But I think I think he was totally corrupt. Not in terms of stealing or cheating or anything like that, but corrupt in terms of what he wanted to do. Corrupt, how do I mean that? In his ambition. He really wanted to get to the top. I don't think he used people badly. But now when he and John Kennedy ran, these are two men who have almost exactly the same platform as far as what they agreed, what their view of government, I think it was practically the same. And so it became a matter of ego, really. And Kennedy just had more resources than Humphrey. But Humphrey, over the war was the main thing. When he supported the war, and I think I told you, he wrote me a letter and said that even if he hadn't been vice president, that he would have supported Lyndon Johnson. And I did not believe it. Because he talked before that, and I don't know, you know, you're young, and I wasn't that young, but you hear sometimes what you want to hear. And I can remember one thing he said that today I disagree with. And I thought at the time it was great. And that was, we have all this food. We can use food in this struggle for peace. Food can be a weapon. Well, should it be? Food should not be a weapon, ever. Mm-hmm. Food should be readily available, and one should be generous with food. But he supported the war, and I really don't believe he did. But the letter that I wrote him, I said I didn't know who he was, and he did support the war. His children were never vulnerable, were never in the war, and so I pretty much gave up on him and Mondale both. And today, Mondale is a Cold Warrior. And by that, when I classify a Cold Warrior, I mean he was fighting communism. And even today, I was at, when was that? Today, 20 years ago, he was at a meeting, and one of my friends, Mary Swenson, was talking something to do with the corporations. And Mondale said to her, "Who are you? Who do you represent?" As if she were a communist. because her remarks were anti-capitalist, because he is a capitalist that's protecting capitalist markets and protecting the capitalist way of life. I do not believe in capitalism. I do not see that the communists have any answer, really. Mm-hmm. But there has to be a sharing of the world's resources if we're ever going to have peace. Mm-hmm. We can't hold them to ourselves. Lyndon Johnson said during the Vietnam War, and it's not much quoted, in speaking of the other, our enemies, they want what we've got and we're not going to give it to them. Mm-hmm. He said that. They want what we've got and we're not going to give it to them. So why shouldn't we? Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't we share? Why shouldn't we share of our knowledge and everything?
Sure.
So that there could be a peaceful world. Okay, so back to my involvement in politics. Actually, I'm trying to remember, but I did a, they put me up, I think, my friends, for state chairwoman or something, because if I was a candidate for office, I had a chance to speak to the convention. Mm. And I ran and I denounced Humphrey and denounced the war.
You won and spoke at the convention?
I did not win. I think I got two votes, actually. Oh, okay. But I was an acknowledged candidate.
I see.
So I was
able to speak.
Able to speak, but that's all I could do, and I think I got two votes.
You denounced Humphrey, and that was, what year would that have been? You denounced him as a vice president?
I denounced his his war policy.
Okay.
The policy supporting, so it would have been in that period of time with the Vietnam War, supporting Lyndon Johnson's war policy. So then I saw him again once. Oh yes, he was in Marshall. And I think David Weiner called me up. And he said, Humphrey is here, would you like to come and see him? And I said, David, do you want me to denounce him in your house? Because that's what I will do if I come. And he said, no. That probably wasn't a good thing to do. I mean, that could have been conciliatory, but I was not ready to do that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do it. And then I saw him once at a meeting, and he saw me at the end of the line, and he went the other way, so we wouldn't have that confrontation. But I was just one among many. I wasn't the only one, so.
So when it dawned on you that in Marshall you would not be able to continue, when that dawned on you, was that a moment in time? I mean, did you have some regrets or?
No, I was so glad for your father to be judged, to be doing something that I felt would be more consistent with his outlook on life than fighting in a courtroom, because he's not a fighter. Mm-hmm. He never was a fighter. That's not his temperament. And that's what the law is about. If you're a courtroom lawyer, you've got to be a fighter. And so I that was not for your dad. So I was so happy for him to be judged that really didn't bother me. And so then I got involved in this UN stuff. And that was okay. I met some people that I liked. And I've forgotten the name of one of the women that I met from up here who came down to Marshall. And I met different kind of people. I remember that I wrote an editorial for the Marshall paper. They gave me the whole space about, what was it about? It was about, because I gave a lot of time to it. It was about people protecting themselves and building walls, and I don't remember now. Hmm. But I thought it was good. And I think I drew on my experience in South America when I wrote this, because in South America, the rich live behind walls. All the people who have money have great big walls around their house and dogs, because they live, that's what I said, that's the way we were, that's what my editorial said. We in this country were living like those people lived in South America, behind walls. Because why? Because we've got all our stuff And that's what they, and I'm sure it's still true today. You have all your stuff, and the people around you want that stuff. They don't have it. They don't see any opportunity of getting it except to steal it from you. Mm-hmm. So they have to protect themselves with these high walls. And I think I said that's what the position this country was in, and that our high walls were our arms and everything else, and that we hadn't come to the point where we saw, where we recognized that we should get rid of the walls and we should open our arms and say we've got to share.
Sure.
Okay. So, then finally they said, finally the laws, it was never a law, but it was just a protocol or something. The judges' wives got active in politics again. But by that time, I was out of the picture. So I never again got active in Democratic,
in the Democratic Party
until I ran for the U.S. Senate up here.
Right.
And I don't know what possessed me to do that. I don't really don't know right now, but I did decide that I would do it. And I'm not.
You didn't run it. Oh, did you try to get the Democratic nomination?
I did. Actually, okay. There are people who tell me. I told them if I got it, I still wouldn't run as a Democrat.
Oh.
I said I want it, but I would not run as a Democrat. I would run as an independent. Well, that, who's going to give that to me? But I still got about 35% of the vote even saying that. And there are people today who say to me that if I had said, I want your endorsement, I'm going to run as a Democrat, I could have had it and run as a Democrat.
Wow.
In which case, I at least would have been considered a credible candidate. I was right. Never considered a credible candidate.
Right.
The newspaper told me, we don't care what you think.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the men practically told it to me, to my face. We don't care what you think, what you say, because you're not going to win. And but I did get off, I got throughout the state. What we did, I think we collected $75,000, which was more than I had ever thought we would. It was about that much. And I decided that I would not obligate the campaign for any more than what we collected. So I did not end up with any debt. And I traveled throughout the state. And when I got throughout the state, in the small towns, I would get on the front page because I don't have any news out there. And so I got great coverage out there. And they covered what I thought and all this and that. And I had a position. I've got all those papers. I had a farm position. I had a position on everything. And I had two campaign managers. The first one, there was a lot of trouble with and ill will. And then another one was, the second one was a woman named Laurie Brown, who is a very successful manufacturer today of Restore the Earth products that are environmentally sound cleaning products.
Okay.
And her father, she'd come from a family, I've forgotten where, but her father was a very successful businessman, so she just kind of fell into this stuff. She's still a good friend today. It was interesting. It was interesting. I don't know if it was a good... We did not have any... The people who worked on the campaign were wonderful, and they all loved it. And I was absolutely free. If you run as a political candidate, as the from a party, the party tells you what to say and what you can't say and what to do, what you can't do. So you're pretty much a prisoner of the party, and I was never that. And I don't know whether I could have done it as a Democrat or not. It would have been hard to listen to them tell you what you can and can't say. And that's the way it is. So it was, I don't know.
So the only gap in there in terms of your being active in politics or in the social activism and so forth is during the Vietnam War when you weren't active in the Democratic Party, but you were active
in the
anti-war.
Absolutely, in the anti-war movement, right. And then during that time, then when I went to the Chicago Convention, it was as a supporter of Eugene McCarthy. He actually invited me to go. And so, but I was not a delegate or anything like that. And nobody told me what to do. But it was obvious. We did talk to people who were delegates, of course. That was the mission, to get them to support him. And then we were there one night, I remember all the Minnesota delegates were there, and we were for McCarthy, you know, and they were for Humphrey, because these were Minnesota delegates and they were party people. But then later on, I saw them with candles. They must have, some of them were not for him, because they did a candlelight march down the street, and I was watching them opposing the war.
Hmm.
And what else happened there?
As I recall, wasn't there a lot of, and I guess it's true in every convention, you know, closed door decisions made around, you know, a bunch of people smoking and coffee behind closed door sessions, and didn't McCarthy give in to, you know, at some point to not save the convention, but he capitulated, didn't he?
No.
Or do something?
No.
On that line? No?
No, he didn't. I think after, people were disenchanted with McCarthy later. He was very quixotic, that's all I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And he was temperamental. And he could give the most wonderful speech you can imagine. It was inspired. It was marvelous. And he could be as dry as the driest college professor if he wasn't feeling like it. It would be impossible. I mean, it would not be interesting at all. So he was moody.
Okay.
And Chicago, of course, I mean, I've written about that. In fact, I started to write a book about that, and I got a few chapters written, and I sent one chapter to Doubleday, I think it was. And they said they were going to publish, they said come back in 20 years that they were going to publish a book that Eugene McCarthy had written. And so I didn't ever finish the book, but it was about my experiences there in Chicago. And because there were many, I mean, I went there with Rose Just, okay? Rose Just was the wife of a doctor from, it's near here. Where's David Green from?
Stillwater.
Stillwater. No, it wasn't from Stillwater. It was from another town down there. Anyhow, Rose was maybe 10 years older than I am. And so maybe I've told you this. So we were going to stay at the Hilton Hotel in Chicago. And I went there, and she had reserved a room. And when I got there, it was fine. We were there a day or so. And then I went out, and I came back in, and she started to laugh. I said, well, what's going on here? Well, she said, they tried to put us out of our room. And I said, well, what happened? Well, she said, you know, Dr. Justin and I stayed here for years. I've been staying here for years. And she was right with me. She was an anti-war person. And very beautiful woman. And she said, they said that these rooms had been reserved for the Humphrey delegation and that we had to get out because they, and I said, so what did you do? Well, she said, I'm hyperventilating. And they locked our door. And she said, my medicine is in the room. I just hope that nothing serious happens, because my husband will surely sue you. We've been here many times, and now I can't even get in to get my medicine. And she threw just kind of a little fit. So they let her in, and they never took our room away from us. So we stayed there. I had come to Chicago with Tom Tiffany. Tom Tiffany was from Harvard, and he was the son of a woman. I knew the Tiffany family from what's a little town right next to us there? Judy Fox lives there now. Very conservative little town. What is it? No.
Redwood
Falls, right. And he'd gone to Harvard on a scholarship or something. And so Tom had driven in the car with us to Chicago. And so when we were in Chicago, then Mayor Daley, I've forgotten how this all worked out, But there had been a strike of the transportation workers, and nothing was moving in the whole city of Chicago. Buses, nothing was moving. Tom was supposed to stay with a college friend of his in Chicago, but he couldn't get there. So Tom stayed with us. So Rosie and I had a bed, and he slept on the sleeping bag between us. It was a little room, so when we went to the bathroom, we'd have to kind of step over Tom Tiffany. But, and he had a press badge, so he got to get into the press. He got to get into the convention. What else happened? I've never told you this stuff, have I? I've written about it. I probably wouldn't have gone out in the streets, but Rose said, we've got to get out there. So we went out into the park. I think it was Grant Park, where all the activities were. And I had never seen hippies before. It was just the advent of them. And there were all these college kids with their faces all painted and in crazy long skirts and costumes. And I can remember one fellow that had on it looked like a uniform, but he had gold rickrack, like dressmaker's rickrack. It wasn't all crazy. And he said, you want to come join my Navy? You can be an admiral in my Navy. And I mean, it was just like a picnic. It was just crazy. And so then I can remember I really did see people, and then they had called the National Guard out. So the Guard was out there. So they were all out there scaring you, you know, we talked to them, and they sit there, stand there with a sober face. I've got some pictures from there somewhere. And then I was in the park, and there were speeches. Norman Mailer spoke. Jean Genet, the writer, was there. Dave Dellinger was there. And as I sat there, and then as I walked into the park, there were people taking pictures, and I thought, if this picture gets back to Marshall, it's not going to be good. So there were three Catholic priests there. So I hung out with them, and I thought, well, if people see me with these priests, it will be a little bit better. So I stood with these priests, and we were together. So when we were standing there, then one man, there was a flagpole, had a red flag, a communist flag, revolution or whatever. He put the flag up on the flagpole. Then the police went after him and beat the socks off of him as he was coming down. And then there was then the police were everywhere, and with their billy clubs and everything. So we scurried out of there. There were also at that time, I looked up and there were people on the buildings around there, all the guards, like National Guard, I guess, with guns trained on us right down there. It was very sobering. That night I was out in the street and we marched. I don't know where we marched to, but I can remember one man, probably younger than you now, but he had his little boy with him on his shoulder. And he said, I saw this on the television, and he said, I couldn't stand it, I had to get out of here. And so he was marching with us. And then they had what was called the P. Blackstone Rangers or something, a bunch of black men. And they were doing their stuff and marching and doing funny stuff. Somewhere along the line, I've written about this somewhere, nobody had anything to eat. This was before it got dark. And all of a sudden, here comes a truck with food on it, with bread. And the people took the bread. And I thought, this is communion. This is really communion, because the people were saying the right things. And the bread was there. And it was a very loving, supporting atmosphere. It was not mean. It was not hateful. Nobody was being mean to anybody. And it was really very moving to me to be there and see that happening. Well, it got dark. And when it got dark, then we were still marching. Or it was later, I can't remember. And then the word came down that we were going to get maced. And so I think I had, they had warned us to have a piece of wet cloth or something. And then the police put on their gas masks, and then everybody kind of scattered. And there were several. This is not a really good neighborhood in Chicago. And then there was a vacant lot and a church, and there was a man, I don't remember whether he was black or white, that was with me. And we went through this vacant lot, and then we see the police coming toward us with a young black kid in front of him. And they're hitting him as he runs, and soles of his feet. And I started out to try to stop him, and the man said, "You don't want to do that. You don't want to do that." And I thought, you know, Mike, I didn't do it. Mm-hmm. I didn't do it. I should have done it, but I didn't do it. And because I didn't want to get hit in the head.
Right.
So we ended back up then. Finally, I ended back up in the hotel where we were staying. And then McCarthy had set up a kind of a hospital up on the, in one of the floors of the hotel to take care of the people who had been hurt, because some of them had been hurt pretty badly. And then some of us were, and I think I was one of them, the police were downstairs, and we dropped glasses down there, bottles and everything, on the police. That was a nonviolent.
Dropped glass bottles on the police.
Yeah, that was a nonviolent act, wasn't it? But anyhow, that was the worst idea. That was about it. I can remember getting on the elevator and somebody said something. I think he was a newspaper reporter, and I really blasted him. He said somebody that looks like you, and like, he really got back at me. But it was a police riot. The police were terrible. At one time, I was out in front of the hotel, and they were moving. They had some, what do you call them, sawhorses. And so I was kind of over here, and they pushed right against you. They pushed it right to the wall. I mean, they didn't care anything, who you are or what. They were very, very violent. And then, you know, I think I told you, I called Marshall and said that I had gotten gassed in the streets, and that's what they wrote. Marshal woman gets gassed, and it. I don't know when I draw conclusions about it. It was just one incident, more than an incident, but it was just an event. You don't know how that affects your psyche or what it does. It certainly didn't change me in any real way. I mean, it was just something that I went through. I think maybe it convinced me that the police, I don't think I'd ever seen the police as the enemy before that, as the real enemy. And today, I guess that's one of the carryovers. I do not look at the police as friends. I mean, certainly there are police who are, but I got arrested one time. There was a young, down here someplace in the city, young policeman who had put handcuffs on me. And he was very careful and very gentle. He didn't want to handcuff me too tight. And so I have to recognize that there are those people, but the system, they're part of the system.
So at what point was there a point where you became disillusioned, either A, with the Democratic Party, or B, with being active in general in the anti-war movement? I mean, did you ever reach a point where you said,
no,
this is hopeless?
No, never with the anti-war movement, never. Because I just wasn't, because it's so amorphous. It's not this or not that or this. I mean, the anti-war movement is everywhere. It's in the churches. It's everywhere. So I've never been really disillusioned with him. With the party, I'm totally disillusioned with the parties, both of them. Both of them.
Yeah.
Both of them. Now, Nancy Pelosi has said, we'll get out, we'll get out in September of 2008. And so I was at a meeting, a fundraiser. I was invited to a fundraiser for Keith Ellison, who you would like. He's a good guy. And Keith spoke, and he said that this is the Democratic proposal. We'll do this and that withdrawal will begin or end, I don't remember which, in September of 2008. And I just spoke up and I said, and how many lives will be lost by that time? And so I've got to call him tomorrow, because he, and I have to remind myself about him, he is a politician, and they are instruments of compromise. But and I told him, you know, he's the lowest man on the totem pole right now. It's a bad word, but the lowest person. He's a freshman legislator. He has no clout, but he should go down. I mean, he should vote right, nevertheless, and vote against Nancy Pelosi. The Democrats don't want the Republicans to be able to say that they're abandoning the troops. This is what it gets down to. It really gets down to that. So, and as far as the Republicans go, you know, I don't know if they're any worse. It's just one of those things. So, that's that.
Okay, so we'll continue in the political vein and return back to a chronological thing.
Okay.
Later. So talk about Nestle.
Oh, well, when I came up here, actually, I think it was Connie, who's the best job finder in the world. Connie had seen this ad, I think, for a job with the Nestle boycott as a national organizer. And she said, you know, you've been there too long in Marshall, and I was in, it was a time to do something different. So I could have stayed there. I wasn't miserable. But I did apply for the job, and they gave it to me. And so I came up here, and Connie was living up here then, that was the thing. And she and I got an apartment together. And that was really wonderful to have a grown daughter say, I wanna live with you. It was just, I consider that a real gift. So, I did what I could with Nestle. I'd never done anything like that, but then nobody else that had applied for it had either. And it was kind of a hopeless job to organize, supposed to be a national organizer, the United States, to sit here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, or the Twin Cities, and organize the whole. I did the best I could, but it wasn't good. But the organization was run by this Doug Johnson, who was not a bad man, but a real sexist. And I really, after about a year, I guess, I wish I could think of, I could go into this, but I can't. One of the people who worked there was Sarah Palmeyer. And she became a friend of mine. All the women who worked there were friends of mine. And Doug was too, in a way. But Sarah then married Jack Nelson, who's an ordained Lutheran minister. And I was at their wedding. So that was, and Mary Swenson became a good friend of mine. Who else did I know there? Lois Swenson was a friend of mine. But Doug, what did he do? Oh my God, that whole thing, it was impossible. I can remember that they had a board meeting, several things, and all of us in the staff had to go to the board meeting. They didn't give us any time off. We had to sit in that board meeting. And everybody complained to me about it, about not being given time off. So I said something to Doug, and the rest of them didn't say a word. They didn't open their mouth. And then, oh, something happened, and my boss was a man, what was his name, from Iowa or something, and I didn't like the way things were going. And I did something, I said, they did something that I didn't like, and I did something about it. And Doug came back from wherever he was and called me in the office and fired me. And the reason he gave me was I was disloyal to my supervisor, which I was. And so I said, okay. And then I said, but I am going to get unemployment, am I not? Well, he agreed to give me unemployment. And it really didn't bother me too much. And after I left, the women in the group were furious with Doug. Now, he's the head of the torture, of the what is it called? Anyhow, it's against torture, you know, there's...
Oh, amnesty, not amnesty.
No, but it's international something.
Okay.
And he really thought he was good with women, but he was very sexist, and so was the other man in the office. And the women did not, they were all on my side. And so they brought in, it's kind of funny, they brought in somebody that was a conciliator to look at the situation. The person that they brought in, that Doug brought in, did a report, talked to everybody in the office, and then the people in the office never heard about the report. And so they kept asking him, and he said, well, you know, I got it, but I lost it. It's lost. I don't know what happened to that report. Well, he was gone out of the office someplace, and they found it. And the person who had been brought in, somebody I know, said that she never talked to me. But if half of what the staff told her were true, he had a really bad situation on his hands. But he didn't want to reveal it to them. So I saw him once since then, and he kissed me. And I wrote him a note and told him that I was not mad at him, but I reserve kisses to people who were my friends, and I didn't consider him a friend. But I've seen him since then, and it's okay. I don't give a hoot. The basis for the Nestle boycott was sound.
I remember it.
It was sound.
Yeah.
But, you know, boycotts against a company that big, you're not going to hurt their business. What all you can do is you can give them a black eye in the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they may have done that, but it still exists.
I thought I'm sure a lot of it was to appease, but my recollection was that the boycott was successful in a sense.
No, they claimed it was and they quit. But it was not.
But Nestle did...
Continues to this day.
But I thought they also publicized, I thought they changed some...
I don't know what they said or how that was resolved, but I do know that today infant formula in developing countries is a problem, mm-hmm. that the women are encouraged, and I don't know if you remember it, but it was a good issue. The women, what happens to the women is they go to the hospital to have their babies. And so during the period of time that you nurse, that the fluid, the colostrum comes and the milk is a limited period of time. And if the baby does not nurse during that time, then the supply of milk is gone, the milk dries up. So they give the babies the infant formula during that period of time.
Uh-huh.
And then when the milk is, when the woman no longer can nurse, then they have to, and then they're ignorant. Women, they're not educated.
Right.
And so they make the formula with unsterile water, and then they don't realize that they can't dilute the formula, and it still goes on. It still goes on.
Hmm.
And so the corporate world is without a soul. I mean, mm-hmm. there's certainly people who run corporations who are good people and who run their business in a way that's fair. But by and large, corporations are without souls, and the people who run them do not care about what happens to anybody beyond the profit. I mean, that's saying it wrong too, but that's...
Our exceptions.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So let me see, I guess that's about it. And then I'll go into that. So what that did, that gave me 6 or 8 months with a salary. And then Marianne and I had been talking about starting this organization. So we had started it. And we started it by writing all the women, by asking people, you know how we started, we took our Christmas card list. Well, we met with about 12 or 14 women up here that were friends of Marianne's, because she'd been involved, and I had known her before in the anti-war movement. So I saw her when I came up here. She's actually a very powerful woman. So she called these women together, and we met for about 6 months, having a supper meeting once a month or so, talking about how we were going to get this organization started. Because at that time, there was all the emphasis on nuclear weapons. And we all believed that the United States could be in war again, just like it was in Vietnam, on the drop of a hat. So we devised a common letter, and we went through our Christmas card list. Every woman took the letter, signed it, made it her own letter, and sent it to the people on her Christmas card list that she thought would give her $100. And we asked them for $100. And that gave us enough money for about a month. And we started with that, with about money for about a month. Marianne became the first director, and it was touch and go as to whether we could make our bills and pay her and pay the rent. But then when I got fired, I went right over there and worked every day for nothing. And that was 6 months free time that I gave to helping organize WHAM. And it really helped. So they really helped establish WHAM. I should tell Doug that someday, I might, because he thought, I can't give you the examples of what a sexist he was. He thinks, and there are men like this, he thought, because he really didn't want to be a sexist, he wanted to be really fair, that was it. Because you want to be, that made him that way. But he was unfair.
Sure.
He was unfair.
A lot of people, a lot of men operate with that kind of assumption.
Yeah, and they're not bad.
Right.
So that puts me up to WHAM. So now where shall we go?
Well, let's go back to Marshall.
One of the things I did in Marshall, I'd forgotten to tell you, I don't know how this happened, but I was, and that kind of helped. I was a member of the Governor's Council on the Aging.
Oh, yeah.
And so I came up here for meetings occasionally, and there was a man named Blado, Gerald Blado, a really nice man, who was the head of that council. He became a good friend. He was at your father's funeral.
Okay.
And I was really interested with what that council was doing, and so I was active with them for several years, and that's about that of that.
I'm going to stop it for a moment. So you wrote Hubert Humphrey.
Yeah, because there was this telephone program, who is the real person? Like, who is the real Mike Mann? And the real Mike Mann could be on the show, and he had to tell the truth. But the others could be as fanciful as they wanted to.
I see.
Then the audience was to guess, who is the real Mike Mann? And so I wrote Hubert Humphrey, whom I had known, and who had appointed your father judge. that I felt when I looked at him and heard what he's saying, that I didn't know who the real Hubert Humphrey was anymore, that I didn't know that I ever knew him. And then I said that Tommy Piper, who was the son of Woodrow Piper, one of the farmers that was one of the Humphrey stalwarts really supported him, the Piper brothers, were farmers in southern Minnesota. And Tommy Piper went to school with Barbara, and he went to Vietnam and he was killed. And so I wrote Humphrey and I said, Tommy Piper's dead, and your sons aren't even in the war. And what I want to know is, why aren't they? That your policies put other people's sons in the war. And so he did write me back and said he was sorry I felt that way, that he was who he was, and that he was certainly concerned about the war and this and so forth. But he did not offer any explanation as to why his sons weren't in the war. And I should have saved that letter, but I didn't. And I just recently, we were talking about letters, I recently wrote the Archbishop of Minnesota, the Archbishop Flynn, and I'd written him before, and I'd had a response, so he knows that I exist. And he had been at the bridge to bid farewell to people who were going to Washington on a peace march. That was several years ago. But then he went down to Louisiana to bless the troops who were leaving to go to Iraq. And in the meantime, there had been an action. This is all tied together, but it sounds kind of, disconnected, but it isn't. There had been an action at the cathedral. And those of us who supported gay people were there, and we wore rainbow sashes. And we were stood in line to receive communion. This was all planned. My friend Gabriel Herbers, the nun, was there, many nuns and priests and so forth. And we knew what would happen when we got to the person who was handing out the communion. The wafer, we didn't get any. They would not give us a communion when we were wearing this rainbow sash, which indicated we were in sympathy with gay people. Well, there were several things that happened. One of the men in our group, who's, a real Catholic as opposed to me, who's fake Catholic, he took the communion. He didn't wear a rainbow sash, and they gave it to him, and he went back and he gave the communion to others who did. And so one of the people at the church, this was at the cathedral, came over to him and said, you can't do that. And he said, well, I did. They said, well, we're going to stop this. We'll call the police. And everybody thought, well, that is going to be ridiculous if he calls the police and the police come because of an incident having to do with who does and who does not receive communion. Well, anyhow, I got refused communion. And so then I got to thinking about it, and so I wrote the Archbishop. And I said to him that, as I interpreted it, that the reason I was refused communion, they would have refused communion if they'd known I wasn't really a bona fide Catholic, but they didn't know that. So I said, I gather it's because you think that I am supporting people who sin, and therefore you deny me the communion. And that I understand. Therefore, I want to ask you, why do you offer communion to a man in uniform or a woman in uniform? That person's main objective in that uniform is to kill people. That is a sin, according to the church, to kill another human being. So, automatically, if you're consistent, you should refuse communion to anybody in a uniform. Well, he did answer me. Flynn answers all his letters, and he said of course he had been down to Louisiana, Mississippi, wherever it was, bidding the troops farewell, that they were good Catholic people and they deserved to be supported, blah, 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 blah. But like Humphrey, he never answered the other part of my message as to, and I've thought about it since, and I do believe that should be consistent position, that the church should not offer communion. No church should offer communion to anybody in a military uniform, because that uniform denotes that you have been trained to kill, mm-hmm. and that when you're told to kill, you kill. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, now we go on.
That's a small play right there, all about the theme around communion.
Well, it could, actually. It could. Yeah. It could. And I do believe that the theater has a lot of power in actually probably more than words. Our words really, they don't hit people emotionally like watching something like that does. And so you've given me an idea. Maybe I'll write a play. Who knows? Shortly.
Okay, so we were going to talk about your experience with the bookstore.
Oh, all right.
Starting with, why were you interested in doing it in the first place? How did it all begin?
Well, I think I just thought about the things that I would like to do. Would be to run a bookstore. There's not many things that, as far as having a job, that really interested me. When I worked as a secretary, and I had to work to make a living, and that was okay. But as I love to read, and at one time I thought it would be interesting to be a librarian, and I might have pursued that, I don't know. But it was kind of in the same vein. And so when the college announced that there was going to be a college, I decided to apply for a job. And I did. And I wasn't offered the job right away. My boss was a man named Roger Green, who was wonderful. He was just marvelous. I really did like Roger Green. And I think I finally talked him into giving me the job running the bookstore. Had no experience in running a business. After all, a bookstore is a business. And I knew the president of the college, Bellows, and I knew his wife. And so they gave me the job of running the bookstore. Well, I did all right. The business aspect of it, I wasn't too great at, really. And the business office was always getting on me for one thing or the other. And I probably should have had some formal
training.
But I did learn a lot, and I had never been the boss of anybody. And so I ended up being the boss. And I learned by trial and error. And one of the things I learned, we had hired a person, and nobody in the bookstore liked this woman. And so when I talked to them, they said, she's got to go. And then I realized I should have conferred with him before. And she did go. She did go. And it was really kind of fun to be there. The college, and you were there, but you were so much younger. The college was started by people who were visionaries, who had an idea that they could have a state college that would be kind of an example. To other state colleges. The people who started really had this kind of vision. And so all kinds of people there that also wanted to try something new and different. So I had a real vision when I started talking to you about what I was going to say. But anyhow, I know where I was going with that. One of the things that the college had done, because they were that, was they had recruited black students to come down. And they were from the city. And these were black students who had lived in as much a ghetto as you could say exists in the Twin Cities, with black people, and really had not had much exposure to white people or middle class white society. And so they came down. The white community was not brought into this discussion at all, the business people, yeah. Anybody. It was these students were just encouraged to come. Most of them were encouraged to come to play sports, to play football or basketball or something. And I really, you know, I grew up in the South, and I didn't know black people except in our kitchen. I mean, I had had no equal relationship with black people, considering them as equals. But because I'd really gone through something in my understanding of what brought war, I did know that we were all the same. I think that because of neighbors like Dorothy Henry, people like that who had really, really, they'd been gentle in a way, but not really, who'd mocked me with some of my attitudes and laughed at them, my racist attitudes, and said, you know, I think I told you that Dorothy told me one time, you're too smart to be having such stupid ideas. Right. And so I had begun to change a bit. So anyhow, so these black students came down there, and some of them wanted jobs in the bookstore. And so we hired some of them. I can remember hiring an absolutely gorgeous young black woman who could have been a model. And then I remember a couple of them. What were the names? They were cousins. And one of them, I read about them up here in the city after that. Anyhow, when they're in the bookstore, we had all these thefts, just terrible out of thefts. And they were thefts of black books. They were books that were written about the black experience, and there were courses there at the college that were giving this slant, looking at racism and what caused the racism. Well, I didn't know what to do about it. So I just announced that I didn't want to catch any black student stealing. I did not want to catch them. And so that's, they were very careful. We never caught anybody. But the books were stolen. So I think maybe that was one that I did catch, was Nan. And she ended up living with us for a while. I don't know if you remember her, but I've seen her up here since then. She's changed her name. Her name is, what does she call herself now? I've forgotten, but she, anyhow. And then I met Vicki Jones, uh-huh. Who's married to Eugene. Right. And so I began to understand that the black students were very disillusioned and angry about their treatment, because the town of Marshall was very racist. And when they would walk into stores, that people would watch them all the time.
Yeah.
And it was a conundrum, because they were right to watch them. They would steal. And I don't know exactly the answer, but there was one, I can still remember one of the women that I knew so well had an African man living with her. And so somehow he went down to one of the stores or something, and then the store owner made a difference between that man. Well, he was African. He was different. And it was probably true, because this African did not have the history of stealing or a resentment toward whites, you see, mm-hmm. that the black people who live in this country did. But they became my friends, they did. And there was just so much tension. And at one point, the basketball coach there, I've forgotten what, Matson, I think his name was, had these players that were black, and they were good. And then, was it he, or was it the opposition? I think it was he. who said that in a game, that they were to win the game by calling one of the opposition team nigger. Mm. Use the word nigger, and that really incensed the players from Marshall. And they some of them would not play anymore. Well, what happened, I think Gene was one of those, my friend Gene Jones, that then when the opposition team would come to Marshall, that these black players would sit and cheer for the opposition. Oh, huh. And this made the Marshall businessmen furious because they had put up money, many of them had, to get the college in Marshall. They had been lobbied, and it was a real plum to get the college. So they actually ended up in fights between the town people and the black students.
Really?
Yeah. There was also what was called the paddock?
Yes.
And which was the temporary union, student union, and that was burned down.
Yeah.
And the scuttlebutt was that the black students had done it.
Right.
It was never proved.
Yeah.
But I do know that there was also a cross burned in the front of one of the, what did they call them? The dormitories, they didn't call them that, the student housing union where the black women would house, they burned a cross. So it was very ugly. It was really very ugly. And as I said, they had become our friends. And we had a pool table in the living room, and I'm sure I've told you this story many times. And so the black students would come in the back door and play pool. And they knew that they were welcome any time. And across the street was that dentist that you hated.
Art Blaufuss.
No, Blaufuss was there, and there was also a dentist. I don't know which was first. And they would watch these black students come into our house. And there was just a lot of gossip about the black students that came into our house. And Walter said that he came down. They felt free to come in. And he said he came down when he was upstairs and he heard him. And he said he heard him laughing and talking downstairs to the black male students. And he said he came down, half of them had their hats on, and they were just having a great old time in our living room shooting pool. And he was amused with it. And that was it. Actually, Gene and Vicky had a baby. Gene Jones was a black student. He was married to Vicky. She did not work in the bookstore, but she worked in the business office across from the bookstore. I don't know what happened to them. They lost their place. They couldn't find a place to live, or they didn't have any money. So they came and lived with us for a couple of months. And, you know, your father, when he married me, probably never had any idea, and I didn't either, what we were getting into. But he never objected to any of this. He never said, I don't want this. He was always so wonderful. And I couldn't have asked for a better partner in my life. I really could not have. So then Bellows, I was having, the bookstore, the business office was giving me fits about this and that. It was not that anything too bad was happening, and the bookstore wasn't making money, but bookstores, I guess college bookstores don't. I mean, after I left, I think they probably ended up with a chain eventually, run just like, yeah, and they probably did do better, but it was still kind of part of the family operation when I was there. And Bellows, Roger Green, who was my boss, and maybe Bellows told me, I don't know, said that at least once a month, someone would call or come in and see the president and say that they should fire me.
Oh.
Because I was responsible for all the dissension on campus. That was all the agitation that was going on over the war in Vietnam. Well, it was, and I certainly, there was a lot going on in the bookstore. But the students, when I would go to where the students were organizing, I would be in the back of the room, and they probably wouldn't even recognize my hand. I really didn't do it.
Right.
I got credit for it from those people, but I didn't do it. It occurred. I did have one incident in which a fellow came in to see me. A student, I don't remember who it was, said to me, "I have a friend that wants to talk to you." And I said, "Fine." He said, "But he wants to come when everybody is gone." So I said, "Okay." So he came, and he had long hair, and he was a male. And so he was wearing a wig. And this was somebody who had, he left the military. He was,
AWOL?
He was more than that. He was, what is the word for
deserter?
A deserter. And he had a friend at the college, and so they wanted to know what to do. So I didn't know what to do, but I called the friends, and they were concerned because I talked to them on the phone, just, what shall I do? They said, "You've got to be careful." But they arranged somehow, I don't know how it happened, but we did get him to Canada. He went to Canada. The other person who was maybe not a deserter, but at least AWOL, was the son of the woman who had the dress shop in Stone. Was her name Stone? No.
There was a Stone's dress shop.
There was, but her Mary June Shapiro was her name. And one of her sons was either a deserter or AWOL. And I don't remember what happened there. I don't think he spent any time in jail. But I do remember that she had a real militaristic display in the dress shop. And I asked her about it. And the American Legion or somebody put a squeeze on her.
Huh.
And so she felt she had to do it. So, and then I met, there were people at the college, Bill Green, and there were a lot of especially the social science teachers who were all opposed to the war. And then there were students there who were resisting the war. At the time also there were students who came back from the war. I don't know if you remember the doctor's son, Tom Ekdahl, was one of them. And I interviewed many of them, and because I thought I'd write a book about it. And I think I told you I submitted the book. And I got an answer from, I don't remember who I submitted it to, saying that they were going to publish Eugene McCarthy's memoirs or something, and that my book it wouldn't be good for my book to come out, to write them in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what was interesting about these, Tom Ekdahl, was I knew his mother. His father was the medical doctor there. Very, I guess you'd say conservative, upper middle class people. Well, Tom sat and told me the most outrageous things you can imagine about being in Vietnam. And he told me what the military did. The military actually would arrange for these fellows when they were on leave to meet women that they could live with for that period of time.
Hmm.
And so I asked him, "Well, did you have any feeling about her?" "No, she was fine. We had a great time. And she had a couple of kids or something." But it was, I don't know. It's for the military to act as the go-between,
mm-hmm.
it was disheartening. I mean,
right.
they shouldn't be doing that.
Right.
And the more I looked at it, the more I think about young men when they're young and just really feeling who they are, then they're sent off to a foreign country, and that first sexual experience very often then occurs in a foreign country with women who are poor and who are doing it because they need money, not because they care about them. Mm-hmm. That, I don't think, I'm not sure, but I don't think that's healthy.
Oh, I don't think so.
I don't think it's healthy for the men.
Right.
That there's a feeling of power, and I just don't think it's healthy. I mean, if things are level and equal, I that might be okay, but I don't think it's good. And that happens so often with young men. I mean, we have been at war. Somebody said to me, today I heard a man named George Kroenke talk, who was one of the Minnesota Eight, and he was talking about resisting, which he did, the Vietnam War. He had been a priest or a monk, I don't remember which. And where was I going with this? But anyhow, he ended up in prison. And he said that he and seven others, one of them was a man named Tom Tilton, and a man named Brad Beneke, and I knew the mothers of one of these men because I had talked to them. It was hard for them all. Well, this man, I know where I was going with it. You know, I don't cry much, but
you've been doing it more lately.
Well, I cry because I'm brought face to face with these kind of things that go on. And so where was I with Kroenke?
He was talking about how long something was, I thought you were going to say, or... He was comparing, I thought you were going to talk about Iraq or something, about what he...
Oh, said. I know. He was talking about the fact that they thought that they were going to stop wars, and the fact that the war, there has been, we have been in constant war since Vietnam, in one war after the other. Mm-hmm. We've never stopped. There's been war, and we now have over 70-something military bases. The biggest embassy in the world, I think somebody told me today, I can't believe it, I'm sure they're wrong, like 20 the size, the area is 20 football fields. The biggest embassy in the world is in Iraq, and this has to do with oil. And so then we talked a little bit at this meeting about what this involves for you and me, for all of us, and the fact that we are all in this together. Mm-hmm. I should not be driving my car. I should be using public transportation, mm-hmm. because it we've got to get unaddicted to oil, because that's why we're doing it. Mm-hmm. It's to maintain our living standards. So anyhow, so I've digressed. We were back with the college. Let's see what else about the college.
Well, what was it like to hire people and to manage people?
I learned that I listened to them. That was the main thing I learned, was that I listened to them and really let them tell me what to do. I was not great, but I was okay. Oh, I know other thing I was going to tell you. Because it was fun, because it was kind of like a laboratory, that college was. And my boss, Roger, was so enthusiastic about what could be done at a college. I mean, you know, he died of cancer as a very young man. That was kind of sad. And he would impress upon me that my ideas were valuable, and so I came up with this idea. And he liked it. And that was that the college should set up a system of ombudsman. That what we need in the world is, we need a way to deal with conflict from the time we're babies. Because in my life, you know, I think I told you, I thought my family was kind of goofy because it was such quarreling. Mm-hmm. And I I never really didn't know. It took me forever to know that everybody quarrels, that there are always conflicts, and that you don't even resolve some of those conflicts. You just acknowledge them, acknowledge the other person's humanity, and say, we have a conflict, we don't agree with it. So I said to Roger that I thought that would be a wonderful learning experience if, when people went to college, that the college set up a system of ombudsmen at every level, with the janitors, the food service people, the faculty, everybody, all the way up, there was an ombudsman to every department in the college. And that when students enrolled, they were told, this is part of your enrollment, that you may and probably will be called upon to be an ombudsman, and you, there's no getting out of it, you have to do it. And that the ombudsman then would be educated as to what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were an ombudsman for the Spanish department or for the food service, you would be told, this is the way you deal with it. When somebody comes to you with a problem, you listen to them and you make notes and make a record, and then you say, we're going to the next level. So you've had trouble with your instructor. So you go to the instructor, and the instructor says he's totally misrepresented it. So you say, well, then we'll have to go to the head of the department. So you go all the way up until the president, until you get it resolved, maybe even the regents, whoever. But that is set up all over the college. But Roger thought that was just great. So he introduced the idea. Well, the heads of the departments said, absolutely not. And the reason was that we figured, and we'd set it all up, I mean, in our heads, that the people who, that this, the interaction would occur at breaks when the college was not operating, and that the people would be educated. Part of this would be to educate all the people who worked there about what the role of the college was too.
Mm-hmm.
So that the people in the food service would be maybe attend a lecture by the head of the science department on what his philosophy was. And that this would be so good for everybody, because then the people in the food service would go back to their small town and say, this is just great. So, but the heads of the department said, this is not going to work. Who is going to answer the telephone? Who is going to do the work during this break period when we're involved in all this baloney? So the heads of the department, the educators, said no. So it never went anywhere. But I still think that it would be a way to begin, that it could be introduced even into schools, mm-hmm. that children could be taught right from the beginning when they fight with each other, this is the way we go. Mm-hmm. We go right to the person, and you don't talk to blah, 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 he said this. You go right to him, look at him in the eye and say, this, we got a problem. So anyhow, that was, so, let's see, I was, as the bookstore manager, the bookstore manager was never a faculty member, and the faculty would let you know that you were not there. And it was interesting because I never went to college, and so I was never exposed, and I had preconceived ideas. I thought the faculty was going to be, I thought because they were educated, they would behave much better than they did. And so there came a time when the funding for the college was reduced. And I saw those faculty members engage in backbiting and nastiness that none of the farmers that I knew, that when we were living in the country, not one of those people out there with no education would have done to his neighbor what those faculty members did to each other. If anything went, I mean, saved the job, that was it. So that was that. I ran into, I think I told you, June Meyerhoff, one of the students that I knew at Bill's funeral,
okay.
At Bill Green's funeral. So, I was going to tell you a little bit about the black students. Many of them got furious and quit and left. They were just And I can, oh, I mean, I can, there was some confrontations out there in which one of the black girls, I mean, she was sexually so explicit when she talked to them, you know, about various things right up in the faces of some of the white students, you know, the males. And I really had never heard any some of this stuff. But even those that left came up here, came back home, and they all did well. I mean, everyone that I've heard of has done well. I ran into one of the women over at the Home for Battered Women, Mavis or Marlis was her name, and she ended up a big fight, and then I think in the hospital or something, a couple of the women had a terrible fight. But she was in this battered women's shelter, hired. She had a position there. And I wish I could remember the name of those cousins, because one of them was the head of the NAACP. One of them ended up selling insurance and doing very well. And so it's really too bad nobody does a kind of a memoir of them, these black students, because I maybe what happened, I've never really analyzed it, is that just being there said you're important. That it gave them a little look at something. And, I remember one of them, Tim White was his name, and I felt he kept testing me, just testing me. And when I'd say something, he'd just test me. I got tired of it. I said to him one day, you know, I am sick and tired of this. You just don't believe that I'm who I am. And what does it take? And he looked me in the face. He said, you know what? Every time I walk into the classroom, I get tested. I'm tested all the time. So why are you any better than I am? And it shut me up. It shut me up. But I never feared for a minute from any of them. It was a good experience for me. It really was a good experience. What else about the college? As far as the bookstore and my lack of status, There were reunions from time to time with the faculty, but I would never be invited. But there is a group that meets up here now, and they did ask me to come, and I went a couple of times. They meet, what do they call themselves, something. But I was bored with it, so I didn't go again. I did not find it stimulating at all.
There were other students that talk about, what's his name, Old Fred?
Oh, Old Fred. Yeah, well, Old Fred was...
Vietnam vet, right?
Yeah, I've got...